This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from South China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series. And turns out, when asked who your favorite child is, you're supposed to pick your own. My co-host is John Pazden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese grammar wiki, sinosplice.com, and intends to live forever or die trying. Listening is one of the biggest challenges for Chinese learners. In this two-part series, John and I are going to talk about the most complicating factors to understanding spoken Chinese to help you become aware and pinpoint where you may be struggling. Guest interview is with Mark DuPont, a lobbyist from Canada whose personal quest has kept him learning Chinese for over 20 years. All this and more, let's get to it.
I am recording on my end. I restarted. Okay.
Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey guys, I'm John Pazden. I'm in Shanghai, China. How's it going?
Okay, John, before we kick into our episode today, we just want to invite you guys to take a minute and leave us a review. So it's great to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on your whatever platform you're using. That really helps us to more people to find out about the podcast and get feedback from you on what you're enjoying.
Yeah, we love questions too. We love answering user questions. We've had some really good ones, but none lately. Okay, so today's podcast is about listening. Listening is super important, and so many people struggle with it, you know, especially with this lovely language, Mandarin Chinese. So today what I want to talk about are 10 things which you might not realize but actually make listening to Chinese harder.
That's right, John, because, you know, we did a survey just the other month for Mandarin Companion, and we found that this was the number one thing. Everyone said, hey, actually, it wasn't the number, it was the number two thing, sorry. Number one thing is that people didn't have anyone to practice their Chinese with, but the number two thing was that, hey, it's difficult for me to understand what's being spoken. So this is one that virtually all of us are going to struggle with.
Yeah, and this isn't something that you can always easily just fix, but a lot of times being aware can help you to work on it and just help you to realize some listening practice is easier than others. All right, so let's just get into the list. There are 10 things. You ready?
All right, let's do it, John.
Okay, so number one is just a male voice. And, you know, sorry, not trying to be sexist here, but females are, for some reason, just easier for most people to understand in general.
Yeah, why is that, John? Do you have any idea?
I think it just has to do with, like, the relative pitch. There are also cultural factors where a lot of men tend to mumble.
I'm a mumbler.
I can't really go beyond that. It's just male voices are frequently harder. Obviously, some males are super clear and some females are not clear. But in general, a male voice is a bit harder.
And I think this is if it's interesting, you pay attention to things that you might be listening to in Chinese, and you will find that, I mean, in majority of them are women's voices.
Yeah, there's a reason for that. One other thing also, if you're getting up there in your level, you know, advanced or upper intermediate, and you've never had a male teacher, that's one thing that you should definitely consider because it's harder. And especially if you're learning Chinese for business or something where you actually do need to talk to a lot of males and it's harder and you're only practicing with female voices, there's something you can do there to improve your studies.
Absolutely.
Okay, so number two, this one's pretty obvious, but it's just fast talkers, right? Some people are fast talkers. And if you're a beginner...
Who's a fast talker, John? Do you talk really fast? I don't know if I really talk fast sometimes.
I am not a fast talker. But if you're a beginner, this is going to be frustrating. So, you know, I don't think we need to say too much about this.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, you got a motor mouth or something. I mean, you know, if I remember growing up, there was that guy, the Micro Machines guy that, you know, spoke like super fast. But, you know, I do meet those guys sometimes. But, you know, there's also those guys that speak very slow. But, yeah, you got to watch out for those fast talkers, man. They'll get you.
One thing about fast talkers is, though, if they speak quickly, but then they also pause and let you talk, then it's not nearly as bad. But the fast talkers that not only talk fast, but also never stop and don't let you talk, they can be super frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so number three is the mumblers. Mentioned them before, often male, but not always male. So it's just a matter of people's, you know, speaking habits. Are they clear? Do they enunciate? Or are they a mumbler?
Yeah, I've got to say that, you know, when someone is mumbling, especially in Chinese, it's a even more challenging, I think, obviously, because I'm not a native speaker in Chinese, but, you know, but in Chinese, because, you know, it's much harder to, like, hear the tones. You know, they're not really, not pronouncing, you know, very well, but just that tone, the rise, the fall, all that type of stuff. It's a little much harder to make out when someone's mumbling. So, yeah, don't feel bad if you can't understand when they're mumbling in Chinese.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mumbled tones are hard to make out. They're just not clear. But also, I think mumbling relates to age. So number four is very old people. So, you know, if they're only 50, then, okay, it's probably not a problem. But once they get to be 70, 80, 90 and above, often these very old speakers, they just don't speak clearly, even if they don't speak quickly. And sometimes it's not even mumbling. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
Well, it's something that you can hear in your native language. In English, there are sometimes individuals, if they're very old, you know, they just have a hard time speaking. I heard once someone describe it more like, you know, like it's like marbles in your mouth. It's a little bit more, you know, like a little bit like this or something. That's a, you know, I guess a southern accent. But yeah, I actually have a story about this, John. Once I was down in Guizhou. We were doing some touring with my brother, and you know, I don't know. There was this old lady there. We just ended up talking to her, and I couldn't really understand her very well at all. And there was another Chinese guy there. And she was speaking Putonghua, you know, so just regular standard Mandarin. But he was listening to her, and then he repeated back to me in Chinese without, I guess, the old accent, so to speak. And then I was like, oh, and so then I'd speak back to her in Mandarin, and then she would say something the guy would, I guess, translate back for me in regular Chinese. And I was like, and so we kind of carried on a three-way conversation that way. It was kind of funny.
Oh, but then the other thing is when you're dealing with older speakers of Chinese, a lot of times their Mandarin is just not that standard. So you're dealing with some kind of accent, you know, some kind of fangyan or dialect influence there. And it's pretty hard to escape with the older speakers, especially if you're not in like Beijing or some place with super standard Mandarin.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, John, that story I just told you, it really was a combination of both of these, where the lady was very old, but also, you know, they speak whatever their local language was there, and that really impacts, you know, comprehension. I also remember another story regarding accent. I remember once there was a beggar on the street, and you know, we wanted to try to help him out and get him some food, and I wanted to talk to him to help him out, and his replies, I could barely understand what he was saying. His accent was so thick, and I think he was from Anhui. And he, you know, I don't know, his accent was just really difficult for me to understand. Luckily, we were able to communicate and we were able to get him some food. But, you know, you run into these situations all the time in China.
Yeah. And again, this is not definite. Like, for example, in Shanghai, a lot of older people speak Shanghainese with a strong accent. But for example, my mother-in-law, she's a bit older, but her Mandarin's pretty standard. She has an accent, but it's not like really bad. Whereas other people, for example, her mom, my wife's great-grandmother, she can't speak Mandarin at all. And so she just speaks to me in Shanghainese and I speak back to her in Mandarin. And I understand most of what she says, but yeah, that's not easy.
You know, I think the other thing about accent too is that there are, we've mentioned this so many times on the podcast, but there's so many different accents. I mean, there's some areas where the R is pronounced like an L. There's the classic sh, which is actually a s in some areas. And so you hear s when you're expecting sh, and it's, you know, messes you up. And there's all this crazy stuff going on.
All right. Well, anyway, accent is a very deep well of information there. So we're going to keep going because there are five other things going on here. So we mentioned that very old people can be very hard to understand, but also very young people. It might be surprising if you never really talked to any kids, but man, kids mumble. They use vocabulary that you've just never heard, and they just talk in unclear ways, especially like, you know, like two or three, like really young kids.
So true. I mean, if you just think about if any of you have kids or you're around young kids in your own native language, they typically don't speak like, you know, an adult, like you would expect an adult to speak. They speak like a kid. And so, I mean, you take that in Chinese, you know, they can't pronounce all the letters or sounds properly, and their vocabulary is limited, and they say things in simple ways, and their grammar's wrong or whatever, and they have little nicknames for things, and boom, I mean, it can get really complicated pretty fast.
Yeah, once the kid's around, like, I don't know, 5, 6, usually their Mandarin becomes much easier to understand, their vocabulary becomes more standard, their speech becomes clearer. But if you're talking like a 3 or 4-year-old, you know, good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, next up would be very formal language. So, you know, just imagine being in a situation where someone's making a speech, or you're at like a super fancy restaurant or, you know, conference room or something, and they just start dropping all this really difficult vocabulary. And this is not a matter of the speech not being clear. It's more like a vocabulary issue. But definitely formal language is going to throw a curveball at you.
Oh, so true. And this happens in writing as well. You know, something's very formal. They introduce this person, they're using all the big flowery words and, you know, literary references or whatever. And yeah, it's I get lost. I've been at some banquets like this before, and they're introduced this individual or something. I'm like, I don't even know what they just said.
Yeah. And actually, if you read a lot and you increase your vocabulary that way, it can help you in these situations because, you know, a lot of the vocabulary is not so common. But yeah, formal situations, not so easy. But that brings us to the next one, number 8, where if it's very informal, like imagine just a bunch of guys just got off work and they're having a few beers and playing cards, like that's not easy either. Very informal Chinese.
You know, a good example of this is our interview with Chris Max. We'll put the link in the show notes. But this is something he talked about a lot, about making friends in China. So he just started hanging out with guys at KTV and bars and things like that. And he just learned a very informal language that's, you know, very familiar to, you know, native speakers in a very friendly way. And but, you know, it took him a long time to really learn that. And if someone's speaking that way to you, I mean, they're not going to get it. I always relate this sometimes. If I have, you know, Chinese friends, and if I were to speak to them very informally, you know, in English, like, hey man, what's going on, dude? How's it hanging today? You know, they're kind of like, oh, what? I don't know what you just said.
Yeah, they want you to.
So the same type of thing in Chinese.
Yeah, they want you to say hello. How are you? Right. I actually had this exact same situation when I was studying Japanese in Japan, because, you know, Japanese is all about levels of politeness. And when you're with a homestay family, they don't speak politely. So that was really hard. So usually Chinese isn't quite that bad because it's not, you know, so built into the language. But yeah, formal Chinese will definitely be a bit tough when you first encounter it. Wait, did I say formal?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, informal Chinese will definitely be a bit tough when you first encounter it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now number 9. This is a really big one. I saved this for second to last because I think this is probably the second biggest influence on what makes listening difficult. And that is if it's a group. So, you know, imagine a one-on-one situation and then imagine sitting at a table with 9 other people and the conversation just going back and forth, you know, all over the place. That is really hard. And so if you've ever been in that situation and you felt, you know, really discouraged because you didn't understand what was going on, don't feel discouraged because this is always really hard.
Yeah, I think there's a number of dynamics in that group setting, but one specifically is that when you're speaking with a native, I mean, they're usually understanding that you are not a native speaker, and they become a little more cognizant of your level of Chinese. And in general, not always, but in general, they try to kind of speak towards your level.
Right.
But you see, when you're in that group setting, you got 2 natives and speakers there that they're just speaking to each other at their own native level, and they're often not taking into consideration your level of Chinese. So it's like, whoo, can go right over your head real fast.
Not only that, but all these issues that we mentioned before, you know, being male, being a fast talker, being a mumbler, being old, like all of that is also sprinkled throughout the group probably. So this is really like compounded when it's a group. It's rough.
Yeah. And then also on that also level is that, you know, usually someone's talking to you, they speak to you, and you have a little second maybe to process and then, you know, maybe formulate a response. And maybe even as you're speaking, you're kind of processing as well. But in this instance, you know, it just bounces back between 2 people. There's no break. There's no pause. You know, so there's a lot of issues in those group settings.
Yeah, and obviously the more people, the harder it's going to be, especially if people are talking over each other. But that's not to say you should avoid groups, but just keep in mind that it's going to be easier to have one-on-one conversations or even two-on-one conversations compared to, like, you know, sitting with a big group and chatting over dinner. Okay, and then the last one. I'm not quite sure what to call it. I guess the megaphone effect. So imagine like an announcement at an airport or an announcement on like the subway, and they're using like this loudspeaker, and those things are so unclear. And for some reason, it's frequently a male, like on the subway. Those are so hard to understand.
Yeah, it's like a, you know, sounded like a, you know, it's end of a hall, echoey, you know, it's all muddled, you know, you can't, it's hard to make that. It's like combining mumbling and fast talking, and I don't know, multiply that by a bucket of chicken, and there you go. That's what it's like.
Yeah, like my listening is very good. Okay. I've been in China for 21 years, and sometimes I'll hear one of these announcements, and it's just like, I'm sure if you don't already know what this guy is saying, there's no way you can make it out, because it's just like, it's just so garbled. It's crazy. I think we often don't appreciate how much of our comprehension comes from being able to anticipate what the other person's going to say. And, you know, if you've heard these subway announcements hundreds of times, you know, over the past few years, you kind of know what he's going to say. And if you really don't know what he's going to say, well, good luck.
Yeah, really true. John, that's a pretty good list. I have one bonus complication to listening.
All right.
And I'll put this one. This is length of listening. All right. Because, you know, you may get into conversation, or, you know, maybe you're practicing or whatever. And the whole aspect of, like, you know, periods of time you can actually carry on a conversation without your brain getting overloaded, you know, that's a really important thing to consider. In fact, some of the research that I've read on this shows that you know, there sometimes after people, they kind of mentally get exhausted on listening, they just stop listening, you know, and they're just going to keep like, you know, but they're not listening. They're just, you know, maybe they're mentally shut down at that stage. But on that aspect, though, it's actually a great measure. It's an additional measure, an indicator of how your listening may be improving. Hey, I'm actually able to have prolonged conversations in Chinese.
Yeah, one of the things I often tell my clients is that if your listening is good, but you don't have enough endurance, like you can't keep listening for like 20 minutes straight, then that's also something you need to work on. So that length and that endurance, that's an important aspect for listening for sure. Although those 10 things are kind of like, they're kind of like qualitative aspects, like the audio itself. And for the most part, it's not dependent upon grammar. It's not dependent on vocabulary. It's just like, you know, what the audio is like. So keep these in mind when you're working on improving your listening, because if you have a bunch of these factors in there, it's gonna affect things. So let me quickly remind you what these 10 things are. 1, male. 2, fast. 3, mumbly. 4, old. 5, accented. 6, young. 7, formal. 8, informal. 9, group. And 10, megaphone or echoey or whatever you want to call that.
That's a great list, John. And, you know, I think for you listening, pay attention to these. So it's something that, you know, you don't get down on yourself. Recognize that if you're encountering specific challenges in these areas, it helps you to identify what is really maybe tripping you up. And also gives you an ideas on what to work on and take into consideration as you are working on improving your Chinese.
Yeah, and don't be too surprised that a lot of the beginner Chinese teachers are young females. That actually does help you out.
All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. Today, our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion.
That's right. Today, we're going to be talking about our level 1 graded reader, 300 basic characters, The Prince and the Pauper.
So this is adapted from the Mark Twain classic. The original classic was not set in China, but ours is.
In fact, this is set in a fictional period of China. In adapting the story, we decided, hey, we need to make up our own unique time period for this setting of the story. But it's a great story, and a lot of people who are avid fans of Manor Companion say, hey, this is my favorite Manor Companion story. It's the two boys, one's the prince and one's a beggar, a pauper, right? And they switch places, and ensuing,
hijinks ensue.
Hijinks do ensue, and it's a great story. It'll bring a tear to your eyes, hopefully, but also a lot of laughter along the way.
Yeah, so this one, don't get too caught up in history. If you're afraid of history, don't worry, because we don't complicate it with accuracy. But it's still fun, and it's not like, blatantly wrong or anything like that. It's a good story, and it's one that will stretch you a little bit if you're level one and you're getting ready for level two.
So go out there and get it today. It's The Prince and the Pauper, a Manor Companion level one graded reader using only 300 basic characters. You can find it on Amazon, Kobo, iBooks, or wherever you get your books.
All right, so now it's time for rants and raves, am I right?
That's right. What do you have for us, John? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
Okay, I have a rave. Because I've been doing some stuff with my kids, and it reminded me of something I did with my interns at All Set Learning, which is board games. And probably one of the best board games I've ever played, I know you know it too, Jared, is Settlers of Catan. And not every board game is good for foreign language study. Like, some board games are definitely too hard. But Settlers of Catan, because you have the trading of resources, you can use like really simple Chinese language, and then you can learn a limited set of vocabulary, bricks and wood and wheat and sheep. It's not too bad, but then, every turn you're getting resources and people are trading. So it turned out to be a really great exercise in Chinese. My kids are almost 7 and almost 10, and they love it. Of course, we're just doing it in English, but it's a great language practice game.
I love Settlers of Catan, and there we have an ongoing joke when we play that game with my family. And they just, anyone got any sheep? And I'm like, mayo.
Wah, wah.
It's good. It's a good joke.
Okay, so Jared, rant or rave from you.
All right, John, today I have a rave. I have a rave. And it's specifically about a guest that we have had on this show before. His name is Robin McPherson. He is a YouTuber. He's a polyglot. And I wanted to just mention a video that he had produced recently. And it was something that I felt that touched me. And I think that a number of, language learners can relate to. Now, the great thing, Robin, this guy's super enthusiastic. If you've heard his podcast, we'll put the link in the show notes. But he's very driven, motivated, and his first language he really learned very well was Japanese. He went to Japan, and he lived there for a number of years. He studied up to a high level of Japanese, became an interpreter, and then he wanted to go to Kyoto, to the university there, and study. But, he ran out of money, he became homeless, and he found his way back to the United States where, he actually had to live in a car. He was back homeless again. And his dream to continue to study the language, it didn't materialize. And it became so painful to him that he didn't speak Japanese again for a number of years. In fact, on the video, is the first time he speaks Japanese since he left Japan because it just brought up so many painful memories to him. And so I love the story, and I'd encourage anyone to go out there and listen to it because, throughout our language learning experiences and journeys, we will have successes and we'll have failures. And I really like his story because it's about picking yourself up. It's about processing those challenges that we have and the pain that we have that goes along with learning a language at times. But despite those, that we can learn and grow from them. So, I get a little sentimental there, but it's a great story that he has, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes and I encourage you guys to go check that one out. It's something that's inspiring.
Cool. Thanks, Jared. So you can learn Japanese and you can learn Chinese.
Oh, yes, you can.
My name is Mark DuPont. I live in Toronto, Canada. I've been studying Chinese for over 20 years. and I'm a lobbyist. I work for a Canadian pension fund.
Mark is an inspiring individual with infectious enthusiasm for learning Chinese. As with many of us, his effort and motivation has changed during different stages of his life, but his desire has not. Stay with us. Why did you start learning Chinese?
In my teens, I've always had a fascination for history, and I've always been fascinated specifically with history of communist countries, why they became communist countries, and of course that includes China. And so when I was doing my undergrad studies in history at the University of Montreal, I was taking Chinese history, and we had a professor from mainland China who happened to be absent from class 1 week and got replaced by a substitute teacher, a 60-something-year-old Jesuit priest, as it turns out, who came on stage, and we were in these big auditoriums, and I was sitting in the back, and I remember looking at him and starting to speak in perfect Mandarin with the students that were sitting in front of the class, and I was looking at him, I was like, I want to do that. That's what I want to do.
But was this a Chinese class?
It was a Chinese history class.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So Chinese history class.
Yeah.
So the Jesuit priest comes in.
Yeah.
And he also speaks fluent Mandarin. What was it about that really connected with you?
I was really impressed by what he did, Jared, but let me do a tangent here. I was really impressed by his skills. And at that point, I hadn't really started studying languages. Before even getting a tutor, I went to the bookstore and I got, in those days, it was cassettes. So I got 3 cassette tapes and a book, Learning Chinese. And I remember the stuff I learned was 我是中国人, 我喝茶, stuff like that. And I remember using the words 你好 at a mall with some Chinese man that I had randomly met, and I wanted to try my Chinese. And I got such a high from even being able to use the one word I knew in Chinese that I was like, man, I gotta keep doing this. There was a bit of an adrenaline rush. And I know, I mean, I really got off on that. And I said, I gotta learn this.
That's great. So you got that positive reinforcement. But, you know, there's a lot of people that might take a little interest in Chinese or a language and study it for some period. But there's something about this, I see, that it's been how many years? 20, 30 years?
26 roughly? Years.
Okay. That, yeah. And you're still like, hey, I haven't given up on learning Chinese. What do you think is one of those factors that's caused you to continue to study and stick with this?
For me, it really is the challenge that this language presents. So, you know, I grew up speaking French and English. I lived in Venezuela. I learned Spanish. And they're in different universes. And Chinese, I told a friend recently, if you remember that Seinfeld where Kramer talks to Jerry and goes, it's levels, Jerry. I'm going to build levels. Chinese is levels, Jared, as you know. So you can speak Chinese and be able to go, you know, buy toilet paper and have a beer. And you can learn a little bit more and be able to interact with friends. And then you can learn a little bit more and be able maybe to talk about politics. And at the same time, you got to be able to read. So it's a constant onion that you're peeling. And it's so difficult and so challenging. And you have to work on your listening and your reading. And you have to get the context, the social context, the historical context. So for me, it's the sheer challenge that this language presents. And I still get drawn into it. And it's still exhilarating for me when I talk to my Chinese language partners to be able to go in your face, this is what I learned yesterday, and I'm going to use this word, and you're going to be blown away.
Yeah, I can understand that. That's pretty cool. Well, I also want to hear a little bit of like, what were some of the things that you were doing? Okay, because it sounds like you got some cassette tapes, you got a textbook, and I assume you went on and took some classes as well. What did you find that was really working for you?
So I had a really unorthodox progression in Chinese, Jared, because I never took organized classes until I went to China. So I couldn't because, you know, I was studying full-time in history then in law school, so I had to get a tutor. So I would get a tutor once a week, and then I'd study on my own. And when I went to China, I started getting language partners. So it wasn't as intensive as I would have liked. So it was a little bit unorthodox from that perspective. But again, I really think if you're learning a language, you have to marinate it. I really compare it to marinating vegetables. You just have to soak in it for a number of years. It's like a sport. You just have to practice it. And you have to meet people, and you have to talk, and you have to talk, and you have to listen. So being in Canada for most of my Chinese learning years, and in other places, I never stopped studying, but I've been trying to create this environment, especially in the last 18 months that I've been cooped up in the forest, you know, somewhere north of Montreal.
So. So in trying to create that environment, what were some of the things that you found that worked for you?
So I'll just forward to, you know, a year and a half ago when the pandemic started. I don't regret a lot in my life, but I'm kind of going, man, I should have been a little more assiduous in studying my Chinese over the last 20 years in Canada instead of just taking, you know, one class every Friday morning for the last 20-something years. When the pandemic hit, I said, all right, everything shut down. I will recreate the exact same number of hours that I would spend on Chinese if I were in Zhenda for a second year. This is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have my Tingli. I'm going to have my Yuedu. I'm going to have my language partners. I'm going to do the whole thing. So for the last 18 months, I've been spending 3 to 4 hours a day on Chinese. I have a full-time job, so it's early mornings and late nights. But I've really been trying to early morning read the news in Chinese. Right now I'm reading Hitchcock in Chinese. I'm reading Mark Twain in Chinese. And then I try to use this. I talk to my language partners. I have one in Shanghai, one in Taiwan. I have one in Toronto who's from Beijing, and my teacher is from Harbin. So I try to get a mix of the accents as well. And then I listen to the news. I listen to Radio France International in Chinese, which also offers a bunch of different journalists, including one who's Japanese based in Tokyo, speaking in Chinese. So I really try to expose myself to as much different accents as I can. And so I'm trying to recreate this. The only component that I'm not really putting emphasis on it in writing, and I probably should, but I mean, at some point, I just running out of steam.
Well, yeah, I can understand. But what is keeping you going doing this? I mean, I got to say, there's, you know, when the pandemic hit, some people are like, all right, I'm going to work out and get totally jacked, right?
Right.
And then, you know, 6 months later, you know, you got a gut instead. So,
well, the good thing is I'm already jacked. So, you know, I just went up.
Obviously. I mean, you guys could see this guy. I mean,
right.
He's a paragon
exactly.
of health.
Hold on. I'll just put my shirt back on, Jared.
Okay. There we go. Okay.
So, you know, it's really peeling the onion. Recently, I was reading short stories. Like I mentioned, Hitchcock short stories. And there's always new proverbs. There's always new way of saying things. And it's a constant struggle to try to take this input and transfer it into my output. I remember when I was in Nankai University, one of our teachers said, if you really want to know a word, if you want to make sure you have that word, you have to be able to use it at least 3 times in a conversation. And once you've used it 3 times in a conversation, you pretty much own that word. So I'd say maybe it's too simple, but it's really challenging. It's great. And to be honest, you know, I'm getting close to an age where everything I do is basically to prevent dementia and Alzheimer's. So at the same time, it's serving a really great health benefit.
So Mark, you mentioned you found some language exchange partners recently. What was that experience like?
I've been really, really lucky. The language partners that I found through apps. And it's been a lot of trial and errors. I've had a lot of people in mainland China who've been wanting to sell me handbags and wanting to sell me Bitcoin. And the language partners that I found have become really, really good friends, even though we've never met in person. And we are mutually encouraging ourselves. Like I can see them really putting a lot more effort into their English and doing what I'm doing. So it's really a push and pull. I'm really lucky. I found some very disciplined and serious language partners. So I'd say that's also motivating me a lot. You still have language partners, Jared?
My language part right now is my son. He's 14, preparing for the AP Chinese test here in the States. So I'm speaking to him in Chinese all the time right now.
Good for you.
So yeah, he might be less motivated than maybe your language partner, but hey, we're doing it.
But you know he will be when he hits 18, 19, 20. He'll be like, man, Dad, I'm so happy you made me do this.
I hope so.
I have to say that in terms of finding language partners, something also pretty cool happened to me about a year ago. Bear in mind, the place I live right now, so I have a place in Toronto because my life is in Toronto and my job's in Toronto, but because everything's been closed since the beginning of the pandemic, I've been an hour north of Montreal. in a little town called Saint-Gabriel-de-Brandon. It's a 2,500 people town. And so there's very few people in the streets. It's a sleepy little town. And about a year ago, I was jogging and I came back and I saw this couple, like it's a very white French Canadian, you know, little village in the countryside, surrounded by farmlands. And I'm coming back running and I see this couple, 50-year-old couple, and I go, these two people are from mainland China, which blew my mind because I'm like, this doesn't fit with the picture. So I stopped in my tracks in the middle of the street. It's just the three of us. And I said to them, I said, and so immediately they said yes. And they are from Henan. And they are my neighbors. So they bought a house a year ago. They speak no French, no English. They were living in Winnipeg, and they were looking for a cheap place to live. They Googled cheap places to live, and they found this house in Saint-Gabriel-de-Brandon, where everybody speaks French. They moved there. And so now we're hanging out. They've got their garden on the side of the house. We go for walks. We have beer. If you told me, like, I would be hanging out with two folks from Henan in this little village, it would blow my mind. But it's been a great coincidence from a learning perspective as well.
Wow, that is fantastic. What do you think your experience would be with this couple if you didn't speak Chinese?
It would be non-existent because, first of all, I look at the way the neighbors look at them. There's no immigration. We're not talking about Montreal. We're not talking about Toronto here. There's no immigration. First of all, there's no common language. They manage to say some phrases. They're taking intensive French lessons, but it's very hard for them to get understood. We would not have even an inkling of a rapport like we do now. And so I'm heading back to the cottage in a couple of weeks, and we've already planned. They're going to give me a jiaozi lesson. You know, they're going to give me a little cooking lesson at their house, which is...
making some dumplings. Cool. Yeah, that's super cool. Now, you've spent some time in China as well. Could you give me some ideas of your highs and lows over there?
So I just want to throw it out there for any Mandarin learners and China lovers out there who are allergic to peanuts. It's challenging, but I would say having been in China in the 90s where peanut allergy was really not a thing and I ended up in the hospital a couple of times, you know, I learned a trick having little pieces of paper in Chinese that clearly states what I'm allergic to and handing it over to the servers, because sometimes you talk to the server and they're like, yeah, don't worry. Actually, same in Canada and the US, except the lawsuits are a little more scary in the US, so people tend to pay attention. But now with these little pieces of paper, they actually go to the kitchen. And I can tell you a number of times, the chef actually comes out and says to me, okay, you've ordered this, but I'm not sure I'd eat that because it's probably not that safe. Let me make you something else.
What happened the time you ended up in the hospital? Can you tell me about that?
I was extremely confident the first time I went to China because I just say to people, and my Chinese was super basic then, and I say, you know, 我花生过敏, and I'd be like, okay, that's... And they just acquiesce. And I'd be like, all right, we're all good. And then I went out with some local friends and I said the same thing and I ordered something. My throat started itching and I'm getting a peanut reaction. So I just ended up at the hospital in Tianjin and they gave me some steroids. They were quite good, but it's not something I wanted to recreate. And then I remember I went to Fudan Dachi. I was visiting Shanghai and I had a conversation with the server there. And I said to her that I was allergic to peanuts. And she said, yeah. I said, no, I'm serious, I'm really allergic to peanuts. And so my dish comes and I'm eating and I feel these crunchy things. So I look at her and I said, 这是什么? And then she looks at me, she goes, 花生. And then I said, 我花生过敏. And then she goes, 那是不多了.
Not much.
Yeah.
Not many.
So that intimidated me and made me hesitate because, you know, I was like, do I go back for a year? But having found these tricks and doing some of my cooking, I just want to tell you out there, you can overcome your fear of Mr. Planters and make it.
Wow. I think that's a great tip. Anyone like listening, right? Maybe you have something that's critical, right? Mission critical to your experience if you're traveling in China.
Yeah.
You had something printed off, right?
Yeah.
So, Mark, pre-pandemic, you were still having some Chinese language instruction. You said it was like Friday mornings?
That's right.
Tell me about that, because there's a lot of people listening who are working full time. Mm-hmm. You know, they got a career, maybe they have families like that, and say, like, how do I fit Chinese into my life? How do I actually make some time for this? But, you know, tell me about what you were doing in the Friday mornings class.
I've mentioned since I left China, and I've lived in a number of different places, including Ottawa, DC, Vancouver, and Toronto, and I've always had Chinese language instruction on Friday mornings. So when I arrived in Toronto 7 years ago, one of the first calls I made was to the Toronto Mandarin School, and I said, all right, I need a private tutor, and the tutor would come to my office Friday morning, and I would block that time. I mean, sometimes you can't avoid it. You have a meeting with your boss. Something happens where you have to move it. But I was extremely diligent about keeping those 2 hours every week. Now I was saying it, regret, should I have had more language partners and really put it into practice? Probably, but it allowed me at least to keep my head above water. And my teacher who comes to my office on Fridays tends to teach other business folks that also want to learn Chinese. So it's very doable.
Well, how has Chinese impacted your career?
I mean, obviously, it makes it easier through the years when I've interacted with folks from China, whether it's folks that work at the consulate or the embassy, or whether we're dealing with potential partners, or whether I'm in Beijing talking directly to government officials. You know, I had my first meeting last year, like I'd say completely in Chinese with an executive that we were meeting here in Toronto.
Wow.
But I would stress, I think it's impossible to learn Chinese if you're doing it for work or if you're doing it for a reason other than you genuinely want to learn Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of people that will say, you know, or you see these courses, Chinese for business, because you know as well as I do, it's a tall order. And if you don't really enjoy learning it, I don't think there's any motivation in the world that would make you want to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So let me put it this way. Even if I were working in an environment where I didn't use Chinese, I would still be studying Chinese. But, you know, Jared, the fact of the matter is the relationship between Canada, China, and US has not been optimal, to say the least, in the last couple of years. So the interactions have been few and far between. So from a work perspective, it's been a lot less. I would say, though, that I live in a very, probably the most multi-ethnic city in the world, in Toronto. And perhaps it's not really work-related, but I was leaving work 3 years ago, and I was going down the escalator, and there were these two Chinese women behind me, and I was standing in the escalator. And one of them just said to her friend, "Tai man le, ni yao tui ta." And so I just turned around, and I said, "Wishima yao tui wo?" And so I...
For listeners, it's going too slow. It's just give him a push, right?
Yeah.
Like, why do you want to push me?
And so the friend of the woman who had just said that pointed at her and started laughing at her so loud and said, So the other one who had just spoken to me felt horrible and covered her face. And we walked all the way to the subway. I mean, I was actually making conversation. It was quite funny.
Yeah.
And she just kept saying under her breath, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." So I guess that was one sort of work-related experience I had.
That's good. You know, what I always love is in that experience, she referred to you as a Lao Wai. For any listeners, that means it's a foreigner. That's a term. It's not the most respectful term for a foreigner either, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, whenever I've encountered sometimes, you know, Chinese, you know, in... you know, outside of China, you know, sometimes we call, "Oh, you're the Lao Wai, right?"
"我是老内，你是老外."
Yeah, there you go.
Exactly.
There you go. You know,
yeah.
You're the foreigner now, me, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Mark, you speak French fluently. I mean, that's like a native language for you. You grew up speaking that as well. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, a lot of my American friends would say, "Well, you speak Quebec French, that's not really French." But I'd be like, "Yeah, well, you guys speak American English, that's not really English."
Yeah,
that's
right.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. All right. Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, so you have French and English. I'm curious, though, do you think, like, already being bilingual, now you're trilingual speaking Chinese, do you think that helped you at all in learning Chinese? Or
Jared, 100%. And I think the more you learn languages, the quote-unquote easier it gets. I would say that I had a bit of an epiphany years ago. I think what really helped me even more than that is Latin.
Really? Yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, have you studied Latin?
No, I have not.
The crazy thing about Latin, I started studying Latin when I was 13, is you have to change your mind to put the verb at the end of the sentence.
Hmm.
So it's extremely challenging. And when you've only learned French and English in your youth, then all of a sudden you're deconstructing sentences. And so I find that this whole exercise of playing with, and also in Latin, just like in German, a lot of the ending of the words will change depending on what function the word occupies in the sentence. So that's also really helped analyze and deconstruct sentences. And I think all of that's been really, really helpful to learning Chinese. So yeah, I think any language that you learn helps towards learning other languages, 100%.
Well, what kind of advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese now?
Yeah, get a language partner. Like, you have zero excuse. Get on an app. You might have to filter through some of the spam, but you'll get language partners. And you just do an hour a week if you need to. You do half an hour in English, half an hour in Chinese. It's free. Everybody gets something out of it. And that's, to me, that's a no-brainer. And plus, you're making friends. And it's really encouraging. And you see progress. And you can pick their brains as soon as you're learning something. And then you can also WeChat and you can text. So you're also practicing your written Chinese somewhat.
Mark, I really appreciate you sharing this perspective with us. What I have enjoyed, I think, listening to your story here, Mark, is just how, you know, it's like language learning's that journey. And it's a horse you never got off. And I think that it's telling to me is that, like, hey, you know, no matter your circumstances, if it's important to you, you can continue to keep this as a part of your life. And who 100%. Knows what opportunities is going to open up.
I agree. And you guys keep up the good work. I really love to nerd it out every time I listen to you guys.
Well, if you came to nerd out, you came to the right place. You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, musician, restaurateur, sculptor, hipster, astronomer, athlete, traveler, and that one guy named William. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SupChina, and our interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, Mark DuPont, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Paston. See you next time.